If you enjoy The Spectator's podcast, why not subscribe to the magazine as well? You can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. This is a podcast-only deal, and we hope you take us up on it.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots. I'm James Heal and I'm joined today by The Spectator's political editor Katie Balls, former journalist and Yvette Cooper advisor Danny Shaw. Now yesterday, Axel Rudakabana pleaded guilty to the charge of murdering three girls in a knife attack at a Taylor Swift themed dance class in Southport last year. This morning the Prime Minister gave a press conference in response to that.
We must make sure the names of those three young girls are not associated with the vile perpetrator, but instead with a fundamental change in how Britain protects its citizens and its children. In pursuit of that, we must, of course, ask and answer difficult questions, questions that should be far-reaching, unburdened by cultural or institutional sensitivities.
Katie, what were the top lines from it?
So I think if you go back to Monday, when, of course, the guilty plea came in, there was an announcement in the evening by Yvette Cooper, which is there will be a public inquiry into the Southport murders, how it came to pass, failures by the system. And also you had Keir Starmer put out a statement where he described the perpetrator as vile. And it was very strong language. And I think obviously the context to this is when you had the Southport murders over the summer, they were quickly accompanied by the riots, some in Southport, all around various parts of the UK. And at the time, Keir Starmer was talking a lot about far-right thuggery when it came to the rioters. But there were talk, and you see it from Nigel Farage today and others, of a cover-up. Why was it not described as a terrorist incident? Were details held back? You all said misinformation circulating online during that period, suggesting that this was an asylum seeker. It was not an asylum seeker. But I think all of that is why, since you've had the guilty plea, there's been a big effort by the government to try and get on the front foot, to lead the agenda on it. And of course, you've had Keir Starmer being, facing lots of criticism in recent weeks for not having a public inquiry in the grooming gangs. Immediately, they're calling for a public inquiry and announcing one on this to show there is grip in 10 Downing Street. In the press conference this morning, Keir Starmer's tone was very much of, we need to, no stone will be left unturned when it comes to asking the difficult questions, unburdened by cultural or institutional sensitivities. And I think also, when you look at what he was talking about on prevent, on counterterrorism, there is a sense that lots of things have gone wrong and difficult questions need to be asked. Now, there are lots of difficult questions that need to be asked because the details that have been made public over the past 24, 48 hours are pretty harrowing. And, for example, he was found to be in possession of a terrorist document. And some of this was known in advance. Mm. And of the biological weapon, ricin. He was referred to the counter-extremism prevent programme three times, but on each occasion a judgment was made that he did not meet the threshold for intervention. And he also had a long history of violence, having been expelled from school and visited by the police on several occasions. And there's also the detail being reported that his father stopped him about a week before from going to school where there might be a potential attack. But of course, no one stopped him when he went to the Taylor Swift themed dance class. And then you had three children murdered and attempted murder elsewhere. When it came to, I think, the Q&A from that statement, you did have it put to Keir Starmer. Some will say, when did you know about the elements when it came to terrorist materials, the prevent programme? Should you have said something sooner? Keir Starmer admitted that he knew about it very early on, but said he could not say any more than he did at the time because there was a risk of, a mistrial, trial collapsing. And that's why he was, inhibited in what he could say. Now, that has not, I think, made him immune from criticism this morning. Mm. And Nigel Farage, others are going on the attack saying that this is a cover-up.
I mean, Danny, can you just sort of discuss and unpack that argument? There's a sense, perhaps, that maybe the police didn't put out information soon enough. Is there a danger, perhaps, that some are using the argument about contempt of court to, what opponents would say, not address some very difficult and thorny issues that this tragic case arises?
I think there are two questions about the release of the information. The first one is the misinformation or disinformation that the attacker was an illegal immigrant who crossed the channel on a small boat. I don't think the authorities responded quickly enough to say that the suspect that they had in custody was a young man who was born in Britain And he had not just come across the channel on a small boat. He was legally in the UK. His parents were immigrants, legal immigrants from Rwanda. I think if they'd sort of got on the front foot a bit more quickly about that, that could have helped. I think the second question is this idea that was put around, I think, by Nigel Farage and others, that there was information that was being withheld. And that sort of fuels conspiracy theories and so on. I think what the government were trying to do was to be scrupulously fair and not reveal information about the background of this young man, the fact that he was known to the authorities, he'd been referred to prevent and so on, because to do so would prejudice the criminal proceedings. From the moment someone is arrested, the contempt of court laws kick in. Arrest. That is the active phase. Now, newspapers, broadcasters, and I know because I've worked for many years in this, are very, very careful once a suspect's been arrested about what you say. Some push the boundaries a little bit. Then when a person is charged, the shutters basically come down and you can only report limited details about what goes on in court and about the charge itself. So I think the government were trying to be, you know, obey the contempt of court laws scrupulously. And I don't think there is any cover up here. That's my own view. The way it looks in the sort of febrile atmosphere of the summer is that they were withholding information. And I don't think they were.
On the point about Prevent and the fact he was referred three times to Prevent, this the man who's now pleaded guilty, do you think that's going to lead questions about the many failures of the state at different levels to stop this person getting increasingly radicalised and then committing these heinous acts?
Well, absolutely. I mean, Keir Starmer's already said, that the state failed in this particular case and that there was no intervention. Three times he was referred. Interestingly, in December, the government had already announced some changes to the Prevent programme and that they were going to appoint an independent commissioner to oversee it. We know now that's going to be Lord Anderson KC, who used to review the anti-terror laws. A very good appointment. He's quite close, I think, to Yvette Cooper. And they also announced youth diversion orders as well in December. So this was, this is something that's designed, I think, to fill the gap where young people, perhaps they can't be prosecuted, so they haven't committed an offence, but there's clearly some worrying behaviour. Perhaps it's use of the internet, some really unpalatable, unsavoury websites and so on, and connections. This is designed to try and sort of get in there and intervene to stop young people, their behaviour escalating into violence. And that was clearly a nod to the case of Axel Rudakabana. But obviously they couldn't mention that in December because we were heading towards a trial at the time. So I think some steps have already been taken and I'm sure there will be more action as well.
Katie, I was struck by some of the language in your blog when Keir Starmer acknowledges the fact that some are concerned cultural sensitivities might get in the way of this. Do you think that that's a recognition perhaps that on issues maybe like grooming gangs, the government hasn't been on the front foot enough about its comms?
So I think because of some things we've been talking about, misinformation over the summer, the fact that this is clearly such a sensitive issue that has triggered riots in the past, I think that there is an awareness that Number 10 need to get the tone right. Mm. And it's a very delicate situation where if you look too much that you're talking about the hard right, the far right, and you're not talking about some of the serious issues and currents in this, such as, indoctrination of the young online, really looking at Islamist materials, having those conversations. I think, there's something about if people believe there is a conspiracy, the more you might look as though you're holding something back, you're not willing to have a conversation, or there's no transparency, it allows that type of thinking to grow. So I think it is a purposeful decision by Number 10 to, talk about, having uncomfortable conversations. And perhaps there is a little bit of a lesson in the sense of if you look like you're shying away, it allows your opponents and your critics to try and put things on you, which, you are not so much trying to get to. And of course, Keir Starmer has been heavily criticised on this. Danny's points are correct in terms of the legal situation, which makes it quite tricky to say things. But you do have a host of people who think that Keir Starmer's more willing, as a politician, to talk about certain types of extremism rather than other types of extremism. And then that feeds into what is a very delicate legal situation. Mm. But there's a general perception, which then means that everything is seen as more political.
Yeah. And Danny, talk us through the inquiry that Keir Starmer announced today. I mean, how long are we expected for that to kind of go on?
Well, we haven't had very many details about it, other than it will be a public inquiry, which means that there will be the power to compel witnesses to give evidence and to supply documents. So that's really important. I expect that more details will be set out in the next few days. I mean, it shouldn't be an inquiry that will take a huge amount of time, because it's looking into a sort of one specific incident and the background of the offender and lessons to be learned. I would hope that it's focused and it's not going to go on for months and months and months, and then it comes up with some recommendations that can be actioned really quickly. I mean, for me, the really troubling thing about this and about the Prevent programme is that the previous government announced a review in 2019 into Prevent because of concerns that it wasn't working very well. 2019, they announced a chair, Lord Carlisle, the former counter-terror reviewer. They then had to replace him because of some concerns about, I think, conflict of interest. Sir William Shawcross came in. It was 4 years after that he produced the findings, 2023. During that period, Axel Rudi-Gabbana had been referred to Prevent three times. We've had so many wasted years looking at this programme, and I wonder actually whether the Shawcross review kind of missed the point. You know, he was very concerned that it was focusing too much on far-right extremism, not enough about the Islamist threat. I wonder actually whether the point is young people who are alienated, excluded from school, not in mainstream society, drawn to violence of whatever hue, are actually being missed, whether it's by Prevent or by the other agencies that should look after them. And actually, I fear that we've had a wasted sort of 4 or 5 years around this.
And just to add, Danny, I mean, you've obviously been covering this for many years. I mean, is that something, a trend you've noticed, a shift over time in terms of the kind of people doing these threats to civil society?
Well, certainly counter-terrorism officials have been saying for some time that we moved away from the sort of large-scale plots involving 3, 4, 5, 6 members of a group with some quite complex terror attack involving bombs or other devices, moved away from that to, you know, people acting alone and just using knives or using a car as a weapon. So that has certainly been a trend. And then what, you know, increasingly is the case is that mental health issues are at the root of a lot of, you know, a lot of the problems, a lot of the background of some of these offenders, whether it's classed as terrorism or whether it's not classed as terrorism. And again, I think we've got hung up about that label. The impact can be just as devastating as we saw in Southport, whether it's a so-called terrorism attack or not.
Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Katie. And thank you for listening to Coffee House Shots. And before you go, a quick plug. We have our first Coffee House Shots live event on the 26th of February at the Emanuel Centre in Westminster. Join Michael Gove, Katie Balls, Kate Andrews and a special guest for a look to the year ahead. For tickets, go to www.spectators.co.uk/coffeehouseshotslive.